missiles their starfighter brethren carried.
We got some of the bombers, at least, Kyle noted.
Like his Vultures, the Longbow design carried 4 torpedoes. Only 750 appeared on his feed, which meant they'd probably killed at least 30 or 40 bombers.
Starfighter screen is moving forward to intercept, Aurangzeb replied. Estimate starfighter missile launch as the torpedoes reach us. Gunther is requesting permission to use his starfighters in counter-torpedo mode.
Flight Colonel Shun Gunther was Righteous Swords CAG, the senior officer of the starfighters that had been held to screen the fleet.
One salvo, Kyle confirmed instantly. He's to hold the remainder of his missiles for the starfighters themselves. His arrows are our best chance of clearing a safe zone for the fleet.
The arrows' lances were very short-ranged compared to their Terran equivalents, but only the bombers matched their missile output. Seconds ticked into minutes, and the Defender starfighters fired, salvoing over 1,000 missiles into the teeth of the torpedo salvo. The starfighters followed their missiles in a moment later, the front wave of the missiles disintegrating into a chaos of explosions and lance fire. And then the capital ship's defenses opened up as well. 10 modern ships layering over 1,000 light positron lances and 4 times that many laser projectors into the mess. It only took one hit from any of the defensive systems to stop a torpedo. But it only took a handful of torpedoes to destroy a capital ship. And with over 700 of them inbound, they could only stop so many.
Kronos is hit, Sterling barked. So are Carolus Rex and Magellan.
Flashing red bands encased the battlecruiser and 2 battleships on Kyle's feed. There wasn't even enough information to estimate their damage, but all 3 ships were still around, and even Carolus Rex could take a hit better than, say, the Imperial Righteous-class ships.
Starfighter missiles launching, ours and theirs, Aurangzeb reported. We have 1,000 heading their way. They have...
Kyle could see the numbers. There were still over 700 Commonwealth starfighters and bombers coming his way, and they'd responded to Gunther's 1,000 missile salvo with 3,000.
Hold defensive formations, he ordered calmly. Stand by to receive enemy fire.
For the first time in his entire career, Kyle watched the missile storm sweep down on a fleet and realized that his part in the fight was already over. 41st Fleet's Admiral had arranged formations, split his fighters, and given the orders that had annihilated the enemy starships. Now, however, it came down to his starfighter crews and starship captains, and everything the Admiral could do had been done. He stood on his flag deck and watched the fire come. The same defensive layering that they'd unleashed on the torpedoes blazed over the incoming starfighter missiles. And while the starfighter missiles were more numerous, they were also stupider and less maneuverable, the price of their far lesser size. Thousands of missiles slammed into the defensive perimeter, and thousands died. Defending starfighters were caught in the explosions, careening out of formation, and Kyle concealed a wince as more of his people died. They stopped the first salvo. Somehow. The Terran starfighters were less lucky. With all of their own weapons launched, their biggest threat had been deployed, but hundreds died as Lakatos's missiles struck home. The second salvo was it for the Commonwealth ships. Their numbers reduced, their formations ravaged, the last Alliance missiles shattered what was left, leaving the Terran fighters scattering away from 41st Fleet, many of them triggering safety pods to make it clear their involvement in this fight was over. The Alliance had won. But there were still 6,000 missiles bearing down on Kyle's fleet. He carefully took his seat, his hands digging into the arms of his chair as he fought the utter helplessness of this stage of command. More starfighters died. With their launching starfighters dead, the missiles were dumber now. They stopped. Almost all of them. Elysium lurched, a damage report flicking into Kyle's mind instantly. A single Javelin starfighter missile had broken through everything and collided with the starship's lower port broadside. A third of the starship's launchers and heavy lances were down, possibly destroyed, but the deck to retrieve her starfighters was intact. Righteous Light was less lucky. The Imperial carrier was still with them, but she was reeling, spewing atmosphere from two direct hits that had nearly crippled her, and then the third and last Terran salvo arrived. The Imperial carrier was hit at least three more times. Not even the battleships that desperately tried to shield her could have survived that fire, and Righteous Light simply disappeared. None of 41st Fleet's ships survived untouched, but the shattered remnants of the Commonwealth fighter strike flashed through without firing their positron lances, most of the ships already abandoned, and others flashing surrender signals on all their transmitters. Righteous Light was the only loss, but that was bad enough. There had been 4,600 people aboard that carrier. As Kyle started to receive damage and casualty reports from the rest of the fleet, he knew that was only the beginning. Chapter 29. Niagara System. 0200, September 28, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. BB-285, St. Michael. Senator Michael Burns's expression was flat. The poker face of an experienced politician just handed a complete and utter shock.
"Destroyed?" he repeated, his voice level. "Destroyed," James Walking Stick confirmed.
His own control over how much emotion made it into his voice and face was ironclad. He might be a soldier, but to end up as one of the Commonwealth's marshals, he'd been a politician, too. Hell, he'd built a damn cult of personality in both the Navy and Congress to get this far. James Walking Stick had no illusions about what he'd done to get there, or what he was prepared to do to go further. Marshal was the most directly, personally powerful position the Commonwealth offered, but it was also simply one more step. The Committee on Unification was the final target, but to get there, he had to win a war of conquest and get elected to the Senate. He could do the latter. The former was starting to give him a headache.
"There were survivors," he noted after a moment's silence. "But Rear Admiral Vasek wasn't one of them. She died with her flagship. The rest of her fleet died with her."
James shook his head.
"The Fox mousetrapped them and ambushed her fleet with bombers at point-blank range. Our starfighters hit his fleet hard, and he'll have to withdraw for repairs now, but..."
"You know what the Senate's response is going to be," Burns told him. "Three systems raided? A Commonwealth fleet not merely defeated, but destroyed? A world in open revolt?"
"Finishing this war requires pressing the offensive," James replied firmly.
"That doesn't matter right now," the senator snapped. "You must end this Stellar Fox's depredations. Whatever plans or offensives you had ready to trigger, your priority must be stopping these raids."
James stared at the senator stonily.
"Am I or am I not the Marshal of the Rimward Marches?" he demanded. "I was promised I would not be interfered with."
There'd been enough delays and issues with his reinforcements, but for Burns to actually order him to recall his fleets...
"That was before this damn war took 2 years, when it was supposed to take 2 months," the senator snapped. "You are the Marshal. But if you do not act to defend the systems under your protection, you won't be the Marshal for very long."
That managed to shock James to silence. He had not realized that his position was so precarious. Burns shook his head.
"I have faith in your skill, Admiral," he told James. "But others are starting to waver. We were promised a quick victory. One that has turned into a two-front war with the only powers in the galaxy even close to our weight class."
"We will overcome," James insisted.
"I know," Burns agreed. "But the Senate is nervous, and watching Roberts rampage along the frontier like this..."
"Deal with him, Marshal." "He'll retreat to Via Somnia next," the Commonwealth Admiral concluded. "He'll replace his starfighters, do what repairs on his ships he can within whatever timeline he's working on. With their 7th fleet at Via Somnia as well. I'd need both Tasker's and Gabor's fleets to take them down."
"But that would turn the war, wouldn't it?" Burns asked. if you smashed that many of their capital ships in one shot.
At the risk of giving up any chance of winning the war for at least 3 or 4 years,
James said quietly.
After losing Vasek's fleet, if I lose Tasker's and Gabor's ships, I won't have the capacity to carry out any major offenses without further reinforcement.
That would be over 60 capital ships gone. Burns chuckled grimly.
James, if you lose 3 damned fleets in as many weeks, you won't need to worry about how much capacity for offensives you have.
James' walking stick allowed himself 10 whole minutes to breathe and calm himself before he started the next conference call. Everything to this point had proceeded along lines of possibility he'd at least allowed for. Well, everything except the war with the League. He hadn't expected that, and it had thrown a major wrench in his plans, but he'd adjusted his expectations and moved forward. He'd thought he had the Senate and their reactions dialed in, but this new threat via Burns, a man who was his ally in most senses, warned him he was on shakier ground than he'd guessed. But he'd deal. He'd always deal. That was the job.
"Andrea, get me Tasker and Gabor," he ordered his secretary. "Priority one."
According to his mental schedule, Tasker was mere hours away from entering Alcubi Airdrive on her way to Michelangelo. Since Gabor was already in Renaissance Trade Factor space, he had less distance to go and needed to be present in Da Vinci to keep the system under Commonwealth control. Priority one meant drop everything, and if Tasker was already accelerating away from Midori, he needed that level of priority. The two admirals appeared quickly enough. At least someone still respected his authority.
"So, what's going on?" Tasker demanded immediately. "I'm less than 90 minutes from entering warped space. I was going over plans with my people."
"This is a full abort," he said bluntly. "Our political masters have decided to override our operational planning for internal reasons."
"An abort?" Gabor asked. "I'm guessing we're going somewhere else?"
"You're both returning to Niagara now," James told them. "Get your fleet moving, Admiral Gabor. From here, we're going to work out our best guess of where our dear Admiral Roberts is, and then we're going to take 60 or so warships out to meet him,"
the Marshal said grimly.
"Our political masters have made it clear that raiding our territory cannot be tolerated, so we're going to blow the Stella Fox to furry stardust. Hopefully we'll pin another fleet or two down at the same time. If we can remove the Alliance's forward concentrations, having our entire force in one place opens up additional possibilities."
He didn't want to assemble a hammer and drive for the Alliance core systems. There wasn't going to be much of said hammer left by the time he was done. But if the Senate was getting twitchy, then he was unfortunately going to have to trade his people's lives for speed of victory. Unification was inevitable. But if it didn't happen soon, someone other than James Walking Stick would reap the benefits. Chapter 30. Presley System. 0600, September 28, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Alliance 41st Fleet. Kyle hadn't slept since the battle, his time consumed by the 1,001 tasks required to get 41st Fleet ready to move again. The last of the Marines had finally reported aboard. Search and rescue shuttles had swept the debris of both Righteous Light and the Commonwealth fleet. They delivered just over 15,000 prisoners to what had been a residential district of Ambrose's capital city, and was now a prisoner of war camp, secured by open ocean militia and attached to the only spaceport the locals had left intact. That was a significant number, until you realized that 17 warships and their associated starfighters carried over 80,000 people. It wasn't the worst losses the Commonwealth had suffered in a single battle, even in this war, but it was probably the most one-sided victory the Alliance had won in the last 2 years. That didn't make the 5,000-odd dead from Kyle's fleet any easier to swallow, but it was true nonetheless.
All of our small craft and starfighters are reporting less than an hour to report aboard, Sterling told him. What's our next step, sir?
I'll talk to the locals, Kyle replied. But once everyone is aboard, we need to get moving immediately. Our course is for Via Somnia.
We need a lot of work, sir,
his chief of staff warned him. And Via Somnia won't be able to do it all, Kyle agreed. But they'll be able to do enough. The timeline is the problem.
Timeline, sir?
Our next attack has to go in by October 8th, the admiral replied. We need to make certain that Walking Stick's attention and his fleets are oriented towards Commonwealth space when Medusa goes down. Sterling shivered.
Yeah, I can see how it could be a problem if one of his fleets is already on its way when that happens, he replied.
Sterling was one of the few people on Kyle's bridge who knew the full details of Medusa, but he'd been part of JSOC. Get the orders passed to get the fleet moving, Kyle told him. I'll be in my office, talking to the dolphins. His chief of staff chuckled.
Enjoy, sir.
To Kyle's surprise, however, the image that appeared on his screen when he opened the link to Open Ocean wasn't a holographic dolphin. Instead, it was a startlingly gorgeous woman with pale skin and raven hair, wearing a brilliant smile and a dark green business suit.
Admiral Roberts, she greeted him in a smooth voice. I'm Lisa Excelsior, the designated head of the caretaker government that's taking over for Open Ocean. She winked. I was also Green Dolphin.
Kyle chuckled. Funny, I thought Green Dolphin was a man, he pointed out. She giggled in response.
All of the dolphins used male voices, she replied. Only four of us were actually men, but it helped keep our identities secret.
The giggle faded into seriousness.
It wasn't enough after the first uprising failed, she said sadly. My husband was killed. I only survived because I officially died in a car accident shortly after his capture. The pacification corps figured it was suicide to avoid capture and let it go.
Kyle shivered. And what now, Ms. Excelsior? He asked.
We caretake the government, she replied. I have a press conference in about an hour, where I'll lay out our promises. Basically, we keep everyone safe, and we have free elections in 6 months, in which none of the caretaker government will stand.
She grimaced.
Keeping everyone safe is going to be the hard part, but you've already done more for us than we ever expected from anyone. Thank you, Admiral.
He shook his head. You were almost a trap that destroyed my fleet, he pointed out. But I'm glad we were able to help.
The Commonwealth has lost one fleet in Presley now, Excelsior said. I hope we'll be able to trade the prisoners you're leaving with us for a degree of peace. And what happens with your fleet now?
We're moving out immediately, he told her, falling back to Alliance space to rearm before resuming our attacks. I'm sorry, Ms. Excelsior, but there's nothing more we can do for Ambrose.
You've already done more than we could hope, she repeated. Thank you, Admiral Roberts. Without your arrival and intervention, this couldn't have happened. And I'm not sure how many more would have died before the Pacification Corps decided we were secure again.
Good luck then, Madam President, he told her. She smiled again and nodded.
And to you, Admiral Roberts. No matter what happens from here, remember this. We remember you, and we owe you. Thank you for everything.
Michelle Williams Alvarez looked at the calmly worded memo on the screen, signed by both surviving Imperial flight colonels and all of the remaining Federation wing commanders. Lakatos had been senior to her, but he hadn't survived Turkey Shoot. Technically, both flight colonels were senior to her, but that was what the memo was about. They were officially yielding to her authority, making the senior Federation officer the official fleet CAG. She shook her head, studying the numbers. They'd lost almost half of their starfighters now. If she was fleet CAG, she only had 600 ships left, roughly one-third each Arrows, Falcons, and Vultures. The bombers had taken relatively light losses throughout everything. The Federation Falcons from the two sanctuaries and the Conquerors had borne the worst of the losses. Elysium had half of her fighters left,
But Avalon was down to a single 48-ship wing, and the two conquerors didn't muster much more between them. The Righteouses probably didn't feel as empty as the Federation ships, but that was only because they'd lost a carrier along with over a third of their starfighter strength. She wasn't sure how many starfighters were at Via Somnia after Seventh Fleet had left, but she doubted it would be enough to replace her losses.
"Ma'am, Flight Colonel Gunther is on the QCOM asking for you," Eklund interrupted her thoughts.
Her gunner wasn't supposed to be acting as her secretary, but her actual secretary's girlfriend had died in the Battle of Pressly. Allowances had to be made.
"Put him through."
Flight Colonel Shun Gunther was a stereotypical resident of the Coraline Imperium's homeworld, with the stocky build of the planet's German colonists and the dark skin and slanted eyes of its Chinese colonists.
"Vice Commodore,"
he greeted her, saluting.
"You've got, what, 2 years in rank on me?" she replied. "Can the salutes, Gunther? What's the deal?"
He grimaced.
"The memo doesn't give much reason, does it?" he asked.
"No. Though I see the Admiral already signed off," she told him. "Not that fleet commanders tend to argue when the starfighter crews say that someone is going to be Fleet CAG."
"It's a simple tradition, Commodore Williams Alvarez," Gunther replied. "You're the 06 with the largest fighter contingent. You're the Fleet CAG. When you and Lakatos both commanded Sanctuary fighter groups, it went to his seniority. Now it goes to you."
He shrugged.
"That you are also the CAG aboard the flagship and have served with the Admiral helps. He trusts you."
"Roberts doesn't mistrust a lot of people," Michelle pointed out. "Usually you have to literally have tried to kill him to get that distinction."
Gunther chuckled.
"My understanding is that it takes less than that," he replied dryly. "There are stories in the Imperial Navy about his first joint operation with our people. The phrase, 'Discipline your dogs or I will make you put them down,' stuck in our institutional memory for some reason."
Michelle blinked.
"I hadn't heard that story," she admitted.
"Believe me, every Imperial fighter commander has," he replied. "One glory hound screwing up in front of our allies was enough, trust me."
"So that makes me CAG?"
He shook his head.
"No. That you command Elysium's fighters makes you Fleet CAG. You haven't done anything that would cause you to lose our trust, either. We'll follow you, Williams Alvarez, and we'll follow the Fox."
"Be careful with that one," she warned. "He's led more than one fleet into the fire."
"I know," Gunther shook his head. "But he led one of them into the cauldron to save a 250,000 mostly Imperial POWs. No, Vice Commodore. The Imperial Navy will follow Kyle Roberts wherever he leads. Our honor demands it."
Chapter 31. Via Somnia System. 0600, October 3rd, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Alliance 41st Fleet. To the casual observer, and hopefully to the inevitable stealthed Commonwealth sensor platforms, the Via Somnia system buzzed with life. Starships orbited the fleet base like watchful sentinels, and starfighters swarmed the space above it. To an Alliance officer, able to read the encrypted IFFs and ping QCOM beacons as their ship approached, the truth was quite different. Seventh Fleet and Admiral Rothenberg's 30-plus capital ships were long gone. A pair of old Star Kingdom of Phoenix Fearless-class battlecruisers remained, mothering the thousands of ECM drones that flitted around Via Somnia to give off the impression that the fleet remained. The starfighters, at least, were real. 100 Templars and 100 Falcons flew high guard over the fleet base. A quick consult with his implant, however, told Kyle the truth there. That was all of the Phoenix Templars in the system and half of the Falcons. Many were being flown by backup crews, lacking the skill or implant bandwidth capacity to actually take the fighters into combat. Via Somnia looked like an impenetrable fortress against any foe, with fleets and battle stations and starfighters to guard her flanks. In truth, however, the fleets were ghosts, the battle stations were undermanned, and the starfighters were stretching themselves thin to give the impression of more strength than they actually possessed. "Who's in command now?" he asked Sterling.
"Captain Loreline Hardy, sir," his chief of staff replied. "Royal Phoenix Navy."
Kyle nodded. "Can you get me a QCOM channel?"
"Already linking in."
The admiral gave his staff an approving nod, then turned his attention to the communication feed knocking on his neural implants. "Captain Hardy, this is Admiral Roberts," he greeted the tall and somewhat chubby blonde who appeared in his mental vision.
"Admiral Roberts, we've been expecting you," she confirmed. "From the report on your damages, though, I'm not sure how much help we're going to be. We've got repair slips open for your ships, but we don't actually have crews for the fleet base's repair systems."
"We'll do what we can with our own people," Kyle told her. "We don't have much choice. We need to be on our way again in 36 hours. Hardy whistled silently.
"I don't know how much you'll be able to do with that," she admitted. "I don't pretend to be briefed on the timeline, sir, so I'm not going to argue. But that'll give you maybe 24 hours in the slips. That's barely enough to..."
"To close the major holes in the hulls," Kyle finished for her. "Hopefully that's all we'll need. I'll need to steal every starfighter you can spare, though." The Star Kingdom officer shook her head at him.
"I don't suppose I can't spare any is an acceptable answer," she replied. "I only have 300 starfighters, Admiral, and keeping even 200 in space to look like we've got more is hurting my people."
"I'm down almost half my fighter strength, Captain," Kyle admitted sadly. "I don't plan on actually picking a fight when I head out next, but I need to at least look like I'm going to." He was relatively certain his true mission had been accomplished, but he needed to keep the Commonwealth's gaze riveted on him. That meant he had to make at least one more attack. It didn't need to succeed. It just needed to happen. Michelle carefully buried her discomfort as she looked around the virtual conference room. The two Imperial flight colonels were senior to her, but had conceded command of 41st Fleet's fighters to her. The senior wing commanders now in charge of the fighters from Avalon, Genghis Khan and Carolus Rex, were all junior to her, though, and she had exactly 3 days' seniority over Vice Commodore Kimi Wirt, the commander of the Federation detachment there in Via Somnia.
"You'll understand, Vice Commodore Williams Alvarez, that I'm unenthused with these orders," Wirt finally said as she finished reviewing her instructions from Roberts. "We already stripped the cupboard here at Via Somnia bare to fill Task Force Midori's losses when they moved out as 7th Fleet. Via Somnia should have a full Commodore or even a Rear Admiral commanding a flotilla of 1,000 starfighters or more," she concluded. "Instead, we have me, 4 wings of Falcons, 1 wing of Vultures, and 2 battlecruisers worth of Phoenix Templars."
336 starfighters," she concluded unnecessarily. "If we stripped Via Somnia bare, we couldn't replace your losses, and then Via Somnia would be basically defenseless."
"I'm not certain of Admiral Roberts' plans," Michelle admitted, "but I suspect we're taking Unstoppable and Defiant with us. If this operation works out, holding Via Somnia won't be nearly as difficult, and if it fails, whether we hold Via Somnia won't matter."
Everyone else in the room winced at her frankness.
"We're going for checkmate, people," she reminded them. "I doubt that's a shock to anyone, but if you hadn't realized it, let's make it clear. We've hung the entire survival of the Alliance on a black swan play. Our job is to keep the Commonwealth looking at the Stellar Fox while the sucker punch swings. So yes, I am aware that I'm asking you to strip Via Somnia bare," she told Wirt. "I've already spoken to JD personnel, and your transfer orders, Vice Commodore Wirt, are being processed as we speak. You're moving aboard Avalon to take command of SFG-001. And we are taking all of the starfighters," she continued grimly. "I suspect we'll leave one of the freighters as an evac ship, because I doubt that Roberts is going to expect the defense platforms to hold on their own."
Wirt was silent for several seconds.
"I guess we should have figured that when Admiral Rothenberg left the system with 38 capital ships," she admitted. "That's the largest force the Alliance has ever deployed as one unit. For all of the marbles, eh? For everything, Michelle agreed. That's classified, but since the entire damn alliance is under comms lockdown, it's not like you're telling anyone. Let your subordinates know the immediate plan, she continued. We need every fighter aboard 7th Fleet by 0600 hours tomorrow. Last plan I heard is that we're going to be back in FTL by 1200 hours. Around her, Elysium had barely made it into her repair slip, the supercarrier's crew already suiting up and swarming over her hull. They'd have 24 hours to do as much good as they could and load the starfighters aboard. Then they went back to war. I know this is a harsh turnaround, and we're barely going to have time to exercise our new wings and groups before we go straight into action with the Commonwealth. But needs must when the void drives, she told them. We know what we need to do. Let's make it happen. Captain Hardy and her fellow Star Kingdom of Phoenix officer, Captain Delilah Sutherland, looked more than a little shocked and discomfited by their inclusion in Kyle's briefing for 41st Fleet. With all 9 of the original ships in repair slips, he'd corralled all of his captains into an in-person meeting aboard the fleet base. We are abandoning Via Somnia, he told them without preamble. I'm officially commandeering both of your cruisers and all of the base's starfighters. We've used up enough munitions and supplies to empty one of my logistics ships, so we'll use Sunlight of Richmond to evacuate the defensive platforms. We'll leave an AI to continue running the ECM systems to try and fool the Commonwealth as long as possible. But once we've completed what repairs we can, we are leaving the fleet base empty.
What happens when the Commonwealth comes back? Hardy demanded.
The AI destroys the base, Kyle said flatly. We're honestly not getting that much use out of it. We seized it to remove a threat to our spinward flank. We don't have much need for its facilities, and we need the ships, fighters, and people we've deployed to defend it. Let the Commonwealth have the system back if they want it. There won't be anything of value left here for them.
So, when do we move?
Novak asked. All of our ships need a lot of work. 1200 hours tomorrow, he said levelly. We are 5 light years, just over 4 days, from the Leopold system. Leopold is one of the key systems for Niagara's logistics support. I expect Walking Stick to have reinforced it heavily, and I intend to arrive on the 9th and threaten it, keeping his attention focused on us. He glanced around the room, waiting to see if anyone picked up on his careful phrasing.
Threaten it, sir?
Bial finally asked, the Trade Factor officer looking amused. We will arrive at roughly 1400 hours on October 8th, Kyle told them. Our job, more than anything else, is to make sure that Walking Stick dispatches no offensives into Alliance space before October 10th. In no way, shape, or form does that objective require us to actually take the Leopold system. And given the state of our fleet, I have no intention of even trying, he continued. My plan is to drag our coats in front of the defenders, draw them into a missile and starfighter duel, and allow them to chase us off. My goal is to be in the Leopold system for 24 to 36 hours, and to be gone before the Operation Medusa assault kickoff, he concluded. We need Walking Stick looking over his shoulder, not sending his fleets at our homeworlds, when the axe finally drops.
What happens then? Hardy asked. I haven't been briefed.
And you won't be, Kyle admitted. Not until it happens. Then, well, at that point, either the war will be over, or this fleet will be all that stands between James Calvin Walking Stick and conquest of the Alliance. I will not risk 41st Fleet to sustain the distraction at this point. We need to attack somewhere Walking Stick is looking, but we do not need to press that attack hard enough to take losses. Kyle smiled. Victory this week, people, rests in the hands of others.
Chapter 32. Niagara System. 1400, October 5th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. BB-285 St. Michael. The entire Niagara system buzzed with activity as the 22 capital ships of Vice Admiral Gabor's 25th Fleet jockeyed with the existing 19 ships of Walking Stick's reserve,
officially 38th Fleet. The 41 capital ships represented a third of the strength he'd had 2 weeks before, the Marshal reflected. With the loss of Vasek's 17 ships, they were now, well, 40% of his command. Tasker had another 20 on their way. That would bring Niagara up over 60 warships. Every ship he'd been given that wasn't tied up in defensive commitments that the Marshal of the Rimward Marches couldn't help but feel shouldn't have fallen under his jurisdiction. He'd been tasked to conquer 65 star systems. Expecting him to protect the 20 Commonwealth stars closest to his enemy was aggravating. James would admit, at least in the privacy of his own mind, that he hadn't cared when they'd included that in his assignment. He hadn't expected the war to last this long. He'd had plans and allowances for the possibility, of course, but they'd been low-probability items. First, the Alliance had frustrated his early campaigns. Then, just as he'd finished grinding them down so he'd be able to take them with his expected reinforcements, the war with the League had broken out, and his reinforcements had evaporated. He didn't buy that as coincidence. It was far more likely, in his opinion, that that whole mess had been an Alliance covert operation. But no one had any proof of that. Not that it would have mattered. Not anymore. As soon as the punitive expedition had been launched, that war had been unavoidable, too.
"Sir, Commodore Corner is requesting some of your time this afternoon," Andrea Messera told him. "I think the analysis department may have a, well, a guess as to Roberts's next step."
James smiled.
"I have my own guesses, but we need to make a decision," he thought for a moment. "Get Corner, Bausade, Gabor, and Tasker in a conference in 30 minutes, he ordered. "And tell Captain Tarr that he should make certain St. Michael is ready for action in all respects."
Captain Boemil Tarr was James's flag captain, an unflappable veteran of a dozen annexations.
"You're taking command yourself, sir?" Messera asked.
Good subordinates were a treasure, James reflected. Clever subordinates were worth their weight in gold.
"Yes," he confirmed. "If our political masters are going to insist I take down Admiral Roberts, then I am going to make damn certain it's done right."
Once again, Commodore Corna and Commander Bausade found themselves facing a wall of stars as James assembled his senior officers for the planning meeting. Tasker was still half a day out, attending via QCOM. Everyone else was present in person. It was a small meeting, the two analysis officers, James, Admiral Gabor, and Commander Messera.
"All right, Commodore," James told Corna. "You weren't far off last time. What's your guess this time?"
She shook her head.
"There's a lot of factors in play," she admitted. "We've confirmed that he fell back to Via Somnia after clashing with Vasek's fleet, but our stealth platforms in Via Somnia have gone dead."
"Dead?" he asked. "I thought they were supposed to survive anything."
"They're not supposed to survive Alliance starfighters firing positron lances into them," she said grimly. "Someone had clearly spent the last few months nailing down the location of every drone we had in the system. They got a clean sweep, roughly 30 hours after Roberts arrived."
"So there's something in Via Somnia they want to hide," Gabor replied. "Should we be heading there?"
"No,"
James replied instantly.
"If we combined all three fleets, we'd be able to take their 41st and 7th fleets, but Roberts won't have stayed. And if they've blown our surveillance platforms, they've almost certainly sent their 7th fleet somewhere as well."
The Marshal shook his head.
"We're in the endgame, people," he said grimly. "We need to punch out this damn 41st fleet and then head right back to the trade factor and finish what we started there. Our political masters want it very clear that attacking our systems will not be tolerated."
The hypocrisy wasn't lost on James, but it wasn't a surprise. Few of the unificationists really understood what waging war to unify humanity really meant. The Commonwealth was too used to being invulnerable.
"But that means we need to catch our dear fox. That's where you come in, Commodore Corner,"
he gestured to his chief analyst.
Much of what we discussed last time around him moving back to Via Somnia applies now in reverse, she told them. The Carnelian or Jinsei no Ai systems are the closest systems to Via Somnia that are lightly defended. The Leopold system is about as close, but already has Rear Admiral Hopper's battle group there. Three assassins and a Lexington aren't going to slow Roberts down much, but so far he's avoided heavier defenses.
Leopold is also one of our key logistics centers, James pointed out. We've basically taken over the local zero-point cell industry to supply our needs. If he destroys Leopold's orbital industry, we're in actual trouble logistically.
So far, he's only hit one of those systems, Bao Said pointed out. I think the odds are that if he knows them, well, he's probably trying to keep us guessing. I'd expect him to hit one more non-key system first.
It depends on how much Admiral Roberts and his superiors want our attention, the Marshal replied. You're right, he wants to keep us guessing, but he also has to actually undermine our war effort, and he hasn't done much of that yet.
What about Vasek's fleet? Tasker asked.
James shook his head.
That wasn't part of his plan. The rebels held him up and allowed Vasek to catch him. No, he wants to make a splash. Weaken us.
The Marshal smiled grimly.
How far are we from those systems?
He asked, running the numbers in his head.
Between 4 and 5 days, Gabor said instantly. Roberts will need to repair his ships. The yards at Via Somnia can take care of his damage, but it will take them time. We've plenty of time to move into place. Roberts is too aggressive for that,
James disagreed.
He'll do the minimum amount of repairs, replenish his starfighters from 7th Fleet, and head straight back out. If he does it right, he'll smash the next system with just his starfighters, keeping his starships out of the way.
We can't let him do that, Tasker objected.
And we won't, James agreed. But we need to cover all of our bases still. Gabor, I need you to split your fleet in three. You'll take one detachment to Carnelian. You'll pick a subordinate to take another to Jinsei no Ai. The third will join my 38th fleet, and we will head directly to Leopold.
What about my ships? Tasker asked.
You'll follow us to Leopold, James told her. 7 ships, with the local defenses, should at least force Roberts to hesitate at Carnelian or Jinsei no Ai. I expect him at Leopold, however, and I want the forces to crush him. Utterly.
Chapter 33. Deep Space, en route to Leopold System. 1500, October 7th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Alliance 41st Fleet.
You know that I have no idea where you are,
Mira's recorded message told Kyle.
But I know you, which tells me that you're in about the largest amount of trouble you can possibly find.
The tall rear admiral he was engaged to shook her head at him with a bright smile.
Hopefully you're unleashing it on the Commonwealth and not suffering from it, love. Be careful. For myself, well, I'm learning some degree of appreciation for these gunships I've ended up in command of, she continued. I'm not sure I wouldn't have rather had the same stellar investment in starfighters, but they can certainly pull their weight.
That was about all she could say about her own work, though, so the recording paused for a moment as she considered.
Your friend Mason has grown into command well, too, she noted. I even got to meet the baby.
Kyle smiled. Mason's lover, his old friend Michael Stanford, had died in the Battle of Hui Xing, but he left sperm samples behind, just in case. He hadn't met their child himself, but he was glad to know the little girl existed. And if having a 4-month-old baby, even if he had been carried to term ex utero, was why Captain Kelly Mason and the strike cruiser Sunset had remained in home fleet when most of the Navy had charged off on Operation Medusa, well, Kyle hadn't asked and couldn't bring himself to mind.
Don't worry, Mira continued. I'm only coming over somewhat maternal from the adorable baby. What Mason's doing is brave and romantic, and I bloody well refuse to try and raise a kid without you. Am I clear, Admiral Roberts?
He laughed.
That was a more pointed comment directed at him than it would have been at most, given that he hadn't met his son with Lisa Kerensky until the boy was 10 years old. But her intent was clear.
I'm pretty sure rear admirals can't give vice admirals orders. But I'm also pretty sure everyone will forgive me for this one, she noted. Come home, Kyle. Kick the Commonwealth's ass, and then come home to me so we can plan a future.
Her smile was sadder than it had been before, and she reached out to touch the camera pickup.
We both know the risks, she admitted, and I'd rather be with you, flinging defiance in Walking Stick's teeth. But we got the orders we got, and we carry out the missions we have. I love you, Kyle. I'll see you when this is all over.
With less than 2 days before what Kyle hoped would be 41st Fleet's final battle, Elysium's corridors were quiet. His flagship's crew were either on duty or in their quarters, recording messages to loved ones or listening to responses. He found himself in the atrium that was at the center of every Castle Federation warship, an oasis of greenery and life in the midst of the steel and function of a starship. Given the religious preferences of the Federation's populace, most of the ship's shrines and chapels were either attached to the atrium or inside it. His own Reformation Wicca was in a perennial duel with Christianity for second largest religion on Castle, though it was a more distinct third place in the Federation as a whole. The stellar spiritualists were the majority in his home country, but his own faith was large enough that there was a small circular clearing hidden away in the atrium around a plain stone altar with 2 candles. Both candles were lit, and he wasn't alone in the clearing. None of the dozen or so officers and enlisted in the space took any official notice of the Admiral as he joined them in quiet meditation amongst the trees. 9 warships, 800 starfighters and bombers, 40,000 lives. That rested on his shoulders, without question or abatement. But everything else his plans had set into motion weighed down on him as well. 15 fleets, 1 million spacers and starfighter crew. If Operation Medusa failed, the Alliance was doomed. And while the blame could be spread around, the final architect of Medusa had been Kyle Roberts. He wanted to go home to Mira and have a future with her, and yet, he wasn't sure that he could embrace a future where the Federation fell and he lived. Michelle Williams Alvarez blew a kiss at the camera pickup, recording her message to her wife.
I love you, Angela Alvarez Williams, she told the surgeon she'd married. I'll see you soon.
That was optimistic, but it was a hope that she, like everyone else in the Alliance Navies, clung to. Angela Alvarez Williams was a senior doctor aboard a hospital ship, accompanying one of the fleets unleashed on the offensive everyone knew was happening, and almost no one seemed to know the details of. There were only 2 hospital ships in the Alliance, both retrofitted last-generation Federation battleships. Angela and her crew had served so well with the first one, a second battleship had been refitted to match. Like every other ship now, though, their locations were classified. No one in the Alliance knew where their uniformed loved ones were anymore. That couldn't last forever, but it sucked for everyone. Most spacers were used to being able to talk to their families live at least once a week or so. Only recorded messages for weeks was starting to grind on Michelle and her people.
Ma'am?
Come in, she told her second-in-command, Wing Commander Evelyn Lin. Lin was a tiny, slim woman of clear old-earth Chinese extraction, with dark hair, skin, and eyes. She perched on the chair across from Michelle as much as sat down, and met her boss's gaze levelly.
There's not much left we can do in 24 hours, she said without much preamble. Maybe get everyone drunk and laid.
That is outside the scope of our official duties, Michelle pointed out. Plus, you're not allowed to sleep with your subordinates. Lin shrugged.
I'm sure I could arrange cross-service integration activities if I chatted up Lieutenant Major Nazarian, she replied.
Lieutenant Major Liam Nazarian was Lin's equivalent in Elysium's Marines, and the wing commander's on-again, off-again lover, if rumor was correct.
There are activities that, if they were being arranged, you can't tell the CAG about,
Michelle pointed out dryly.
Where are we, Evelyn? You want to take this lot into battle? We're fucked, and not in a way anyone's going to enjoy,
Lynn said flatly.
We're running short an entire wing, and have the lowest ratio of replacements in the fleet, and I wouldn't want to put us in the line of fire for another week.
You figure the rest of the fleet's worse? It wasn't a question. Of course, Lynn figured Elysium's fighter group was in the best shape.
No one's pure cannon fodder, the wing commander said after a moment's thought. But none of us are where I'd like to be. We're running up against real defenses in Leopold. They're going to be ready for us, and we're not ready for them.
We have to be, Michelle said quietly. We go to war when we have to with the crews we have, not when we'd like to with the crews we wish we had.
How bad is it, Evelyn?
Lynn winced and sighed.
The raw material is solid, and we had a decent matrix to drop them into, she admitted. And most of the rest of the fleet we slotted entire squadrons into, but the two new Phoenix cruisers are the only ones with intact fighter groups. Everyone else is either flying with a new wing, a new squadron leader, or a new wing leader. No one is going to screw up, but we're going to lose a lot more people than we should.
Michelle nodded with her own sigh.
We don't have a choice, Evelyn. The timeline is what it is. Why? Lynn asked. I haven't been briefed on any of this shit. We're sending our people into the fire before they're ready, and I don't even know why.
Michelle considered for a moment, then shrugged.
I don't know everything, she admitted. What I do know is that the entire offensive that's been launched is scheduled to hit home on the 9th. We need Walking Stick watching his back, not attacking us when it does. So the timing is the most important part of this. We have to go out.
Lynn chuckled bitterly.
You were never high guard, were you, Vice Commodore?
No, Michelle admitted. High guard were local planetary patrols, starfighters and boarding shuttles permanently dedicated to policing the orbits of inhabited worlds, the spaceborne equivalent of a coast guard.
If you had been, you'd know the other half of that statement,
Lynn, who had been a high guard squadron leader before the war, said.
Which is? We have to go out. We don't have to come back.
Chapter 34. Leopold System. 0800, October 9th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Alliance 41st Fleet. If 41st Fleet had been trying to be sneaky, the shrews would have provided a brilliant opportunity. Leopold's 7th and 8th planets, Harriet and Margaret, were gas giants to put Sol's Jupiter and Saturn to shame. Hiding the Alcubierre emergencies of an entire fleet behind them would have taken some doing, but it might have actually been possible. Most systems' planets didn't allow for that level of stealth. Of course, the shrews had a shared name because they shared an orbit, and they were currently on the far side of the Leopold system from Katrina, the habitable fourth planet. Since Katrina and Henriette, the uninhabitable but resource-rich third planet, were the focus of Leopold's population and industry, they were also the focus of Kyle's attack. 11 warships burst into reality, Q-probes firing away in the moment they emerged, and scanners reaching out to find the enemies that they knew were there.
Starfighters deploying, Sterling reported. Passive scanner take coming in now.
Leopold should have both a fleet and significant fixed defenses. There were no surprises in the passive take. The data was 2 minutes old, though as the Q-probes got closer to the planet, the data would get fresher.
Looks like bang on what intelligence suggested, Aurangzeb reported. I've got 3 cruisers, a carrier, about 20 defensive platforms. Only half appear to be fighter bases. 100 katanas on patrol. That number will start ramping up quickly. Best guess is about 750 fighters with heavy missile support.
Kyle nodded, watching the data signatures continue to populate his feed as Aurangzeb's team identified the various civilian orbit platforms as well. Leopold was the most heavily industrialized of the systems they'd moved against so far, with significant home-built defenses. Many of the fighters that they were picking up would be high-guard ships, more used to being police officers than combatants. Underestimating them could be deadly. Those pilots were fighting for their homes, their families. "Let's go with course Delta 3," he told Sterling. "Keep us on the far side of Katrina from Henriette, and watch our distance and vector from space we can jump from." Everything was exactly as he'd expected. It was a light enough defense force that he could take them if he pushed, and a heavy enough defense force that his enemies wouldn't question him choosing to withdraw rather than take heavy losses. If everything in Leopold was exactly what he needed, why did the hair on the back of his neck want to climb his skull?
"All fighters, form up, form up," Michelle barked. "Falcons and Templars, primary defensive formation Epsilon 3, 2 million clicks in front of the fleet. Arrows, secondary defensive formation Alpha 1, stick to the cap ships like glue. Acknowledge."
Acknowledgements flickered back from her subordinates as hundreds of starfighters leapt to her orders. It was a heady feeling, and a terrifying one. If they got the plan wrong, if they had the wrong formation or the wrong division of fighters, or if there was something they'd missed. 200 arrows formed up around 41st Fleet behind her, and she led 400 Falcons and 100 Templars forward, accelerating over twice as fast as the fleet as they opened the distance.
"Enemy starfighters deploying," Eklund reported. "Numbers match up with 3 Assassins, a Lexington, and 12 Zions. 800 Katanas, 50 Longbows."
He paused.
"What about our bombers, ma'am?"
"The Admiral is hanging on to them just in case," she told him. "The plan isn't actually to take the system today, Ferdy. We're just here to make them look."
Eklund snorted. 850 starfighters and 3 battlecruisers are definitely looking, boss," he pointed out.
He was right. The 3 Assassins had formed up into a triangle formation, with the starfighters filling in the gaps to form a massive spearhead thrusting directly toward 41st Fleet. It was a moving wall of antimatter fire, closing with the Alliance at 200 gravities. As capital ship missiles launched and ECM flared to life, that wall became a solid shield of radiation and jamming. There weren't going to be many long-range hits today.
"Fleet is opening fire with missiles," Eklund told her. "What do we do?"
"Hold course and plan," she said calmly. "We'll swing around Katrina, draw their forces out, and chop off chunks of them as we swing by."
"We could totally take them," her gunner objected.
"Probably," Michelle agreed. "But the Admiral doesn't want to lose more people than he has to over a system the Alliance doesn't want or need. So, we go by the plan."
"Do we have any Q-probes in position to look up dear Admiral Hopper's skirt?" Kyle asked conversationally. "I don't like the way our Terran friend is blocking our view of a nice, shiny chunk of space."
"We've accounted for all of his ships and starfighters," Aurangzeb pointed out. "What could he be hiding?"
"Ships we don't know about," Kyle replied. "We've seen everything we knew about, but I expected Leopold to be reinforced. While we're at it, get me a probe hooked around Henriette. We haven't seen the dark side of that rock yet, and my paranoia is itchy."
His chief of staff and operations officer both chuckled at his joke, but they also got to work. The Q-probes were launched in waves. A first wave that blasted through the system at the same 1,000 gravities as a missile, then turned around and came back. 3 more waves that did much the same thing at lower accelerations, and a final wave of probes that slowed themselves into stealth position across the star system, providing a live view of a battle space that would, at a minimum, be 2 light minutes across. His staff went to work on the third wave, adjusting the courses of some Q-probes and accelerating others, wrapping them around towards Kyle's blind spots.
"Sending probes B-18 through B-22 on a suicide run into the fleet," Aurangzeb reported after a minute. "Give me 5 minutes and I'll know what Hopper has under his skirt. 3 of the C-wave probes are looping Henriette. That'll be 15 minutes. First missile impacts in 25 minutes. They'll have torpedo range on our forward fighter formation in 33.
Kyle nodded his understanding, watching the drama continue to unfold. They'd thrown over 1,000 missiles at Task Force Leopold so far, and he considered that expenditure for a moment.
"Hold the missile fire after 10 salvos," he ordered. 2,000 missiles have a better than 50-50 chance of clearing those battlecruisers out of the fight, and I'd like to hang on to our other 90 salvos. Just in case.
Understood. Passing the order, Aurangzeb replied.